Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkinet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. I think it's a Friday. It's a sunny blue day here in Scotland, so we're doing okay. One of the big news stories this week are reports that President Trump is interested in having a enormous military parade. It seems to be inspired by his trip to France a year ago, in which he saw the Bastille Day parade, and he wants to have a big parade with tanks and all kinds of things, and planes and soldiers and whatnot. This report has been widely criticized on both sides of the aisle, where people have saying this is more akin to the kind of event that would be staged by a dictatorship than by a democracy, and as something that is more akin to Soviet Russia than it is to the United States. So Frank, how some people are saying Trump's idea for having a big military parade is un-American. How un-American is it?
It's not quite as un-American as the immediate press reports would have us believe, I think. The first thing I'd observe is, and I sympathize with the anxiety expressed by people about this idea or the kind of criticism of it, but it is worth observing that, of course, France is a democracy, and France does have a big parade of this kind every year on Bastille Day. But in the United States, there is a fairly, to call it a traditional would be an overstatement, but there is a history of military parades, usually associated with the 4th of July, sometimes with Memorial Day or Veterans Day, days which are meant to honor the military. But it goes way back. So John Adams reviewed troops. There was a sort of small parade in 1798. Thomas Jefferson did on the 4th of July in 1803 and 1804. James Madison reviewed troops during his presidency.
Okay, but I'm just curious about how, when we're talking about reviewing the troops, are we talking huge columns of thousands of people? What are we talking about here?
No, we're talking dozens, probably.
Dozens of people.
Well, because the U.S. military in this period is very, very small. Mm-hmm. It's a few thousand soldiers. What happens during wartime in the very early Republic is state militias are conscripted and kind of brought into the army, as you know. And so the U.S. military...
You can review the whole military and still have time for drinks afterwards.
That's right. Yeah. In 1803 or 1804 is very small. So this is the first grand kind of military parade in American history, I think, is in your period, David, isn't it? I mean, we have these late 18th, early 19th century examples, but they're pretty infrequent. But it's the grand review in 1865, isn't it?
Well, so yeah, the grand review in... late May of 1865, so this is on the 23rd and 24th of May. So this, if you're thinking about when the Civil War ends, you've got Appomattox in early April, you've got some other Confederate surrenders in late April and early May. This grand review basically is a way often historians treat it, this is the symbolic end of the war. There's still a handful of rogue Confederates sort of out there, but this is
still are, David. Sorry.
I wouldn't disagree with you on that point, but these was the symbolic end, if you will, to the war. On the 23rd of April, the Army of the Potomac, George Meade's army, some 80,000 men paraded through D.C., and on the 24th of May, the Army of the Tennessee, that is Sherman's army, some 65,000 men, paraded through D.C. In front of the bandstand had General Grant and President Andrew Johnson, who of course had just taken over a month beforehand after the Lincoln assassination.
And crucially, I think, David, correct me if I'm wrong, this is sometimes seen as a kind of almost the end of the mourning period after the assassination of Lincoln.
Yes,
a kind of celebration of the end of the war.
Yes,
and almost the end of the.
Well, and it's also the end of military service for all these guys, right?
So they're being demobilized.
It is a celebration of the coming of peacetime in a way, in as much as the model of the U.S. Army during the 19th century, really into the 20th century, is you raise an army to fight a war. Once the war is over, the people go home. And so this is, in some ways, the moment in which these guys become, are transitioning from being soldiers to being veterans. So they are, this is about, you know, the entering of a new phase of American history in a post-war period. So in some ways, it's a demonstration of military strength, but at the same time, it's a military strength that evaporates as soon as you demonstrate it.
Right.
You know, so it's very different than sort of the sort of military parades that Trump's military, you know, imagined military parade is often people are afraid of. It's not a symbol of strength about what we might do to one's enemies. This is in some ways about celebrating or recognizing the sacrifices of these soldiers who fought in the Civil War and the ones who fought in the Civil War and weren't able to march as well. But it was as much about honoring them and giving them a sort of a culmination to their military experience before they went back to civilian life. So, you know, one of the things to think about these military parades, both in the things in the 19th century, but also obviously now, is, you know, who are the parades for?
Yeah, how many people watched this grand review?
Thousands, but I think there are probably more people marching than there were actually watching, right? And obviously it's not going to be, there's some photos of it, and it's, you know, seen as, the soldiers saw it as critically important, it was well covered in newspapers. But ultimately, I think it's a parade that was ultimately for the soldiers, and you know, as a rite of passage, if you will, more than it is for an external audience in a way.
Whereas more modern displays are really intended both for the audience that's there, and of course, thanks to television and now social media and everything else, it's a statement to the wider world. In fact, some of the criticism of President Trump's proposal, both from the left and the right, have been, well, we don't do this. Mm. We shouldn't do this. We've got a very strong military. The world knows that. In fact, it makes the country look weak to
the comparison today that people are making is, it's like either like the Soviet Union / Russia, or it's like dictatorships like North Korea, who constantly have these kinds of military parades to honor both their leader and to demonstrate their imagined military power.
Right. It's almost a case of if you have to make that demonstration, you're not as strong as you seem to be. But of course, in the 20th century, there were far more military parades, I think, than people realize. Mm. So there was a big parade in New York at the end of the First World War in 1919. There were military parades in during and after the Second World War. Mm. Again, particularly the largest ones were in New York. So in 1942, there was one in New York. Although that was really about marshaling American strength, it was entering the conflict.
And about sending boys, men off to fight in Europe. So it's about it. You know, one of the reasons why I think New York is an important point in World War One and World War Two is it's also the most important harbor. And so, in terms of actually,
well, it's an embarkation point.
It's, you know, just the way that New York's important for site for immigration. It also was in both of those wars an important port for exporting American troops to Europe. And so, part of the reason why I think it had that central location purpose in the First and Second World Wars, because it actually was an important military location, in a sense, in terms of
But it's also got a huge amount of cultural significance as well as the economic and cultural capital of the country as well. But in 1946, there's a big parade to mark the end of the Second World War, which was akin to the 1919 parade, I think.
And you know, they had tanks and they had people from the 82nd Airborne and all this kind of stuff.
Right, but again, it wasn't a sort of May Day-style demonstration of American strength so much as it was a, as I said, a commemoration of the... It was more akin to your grand review.
I think so, in as much as a lot of those guys are being demobilized, right, yeah.
Whereas things changed during the Cold War. So, and again, often forgotten by people in some of the commentary over the past few days, when Eisenhower was inaugurated in 1953 and in 1957, there were military-style parades as part of his inauguration, and that tradition continued, if tradition we can call it, with Kennedy's inauguration in 1961, where we had tanks and missiles displays of military hardware.
Including sort of cutting-edge military hardware. I mean, one of the things that's striking about the military hardware that's displayed in the Eisenhower and Kennedy inaugurations is those are places where those weapons are being displayed for the first time. If you compare that to, say, the parade in 1946 when they have tanks going down Broadway or whatever in parades there, those were tanks that have been used.
Right.
This is about displaying the weapons that had been used in some way, instead of displaying weapons we might use in the future.
So rather than celebrating the end of a conflict and the boys coming home and leaving the army in this transition to peace, these inaugural parades in 53, 57, and 61 were very much about sending a signal to the Soviet Union, which at that point, particularly in the wake of Sputnik, seemed to be either on a par with the United States or having surpassed the United States in technology.
Yeah, so technology. Khrushchev is doing similar kinds of parades in Moscow at the same time, demonstrating, you know, showcasing new missiles and what have you and the strength of the Red Army. I mean, Eisenhower has something like, there's like an 85-ton atomic cannon that gets put on display, and Kennedy's has got some new, you know, Nike missile technologies and whatnot. So it's an interesting moment thinking about the relationship between sort of the military and the inauguration, what the inauguration is supposed to mean and supposed to signal.
Well, you know, under the Constitution, of course, the President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. And that's crucial, and it's a crucial theme in American history and American life is civilian control of the military.
Yeah.
And this goes right back to George Washington and Washington accepting, even during the Revolution, that the civilians were in charge. And this has been more or less respected throughout the history of the United States.
Mm.
The rise of the national security state since 1945, I think, has seen a blurring of this. And as in so many other ways where President Trump is kind of overturning norms, this is an area where I don't think he's necessarily doing it deliberately, but there is a blurring, I think, of the authority, in part because he loves the military so much. He loves generals. He surrounds himself with generals. And I think he has a very narrow definition of patriotism that equates to celebrating and venerating the military.
Yeah. I mean, so thinking about the way in which Trump is sort of wrapping himself in the military, he's doing that, I think, in several different ways. One, I think you're right, he's surrounding himself by generals. He's surrounding his chief
of... former generals.
Or former generals, but I think somehow these former generals are, you know, once a general, always a general.
Yeah.
Old soldiers don't die, they just fade away kind of things. You know, his chief of staff's a general, his national security advisor is a general, you know, and he often talks about his generals, which is sort of interesting... Yeah. Nomenclature. Some people have noticed that in the renovations that happened in the White House earlier this year, one of the changes that was made in the Oval Office over previous Oval Offices is usually there are two flags in the Oval Office. There's usually the American flag and then there's the presidential flag. Trump has added several more American flags, but he's also added the flags of the armed forces, so the Army flag, the Navy flag, the Marine Corps flag. I don't know whether he's got the Coast Guard flag there or not, but
he must have the Air Force, but
they're very prominent in the Oval Office now. You often see pictures of these military flags that historically weren't there. I mean, I've seen sort of photo studies of the Oval Office, and the presence of two flags has been sort of a constant going back more than 100 years, you know, putting military flags in for front and center has been, I think, an interesting innovation of Trump wrapping himself in military garb, in a sense.
Yes, but let's go back to those, to the Eisenhower and Kennedy inaugurations, because I think I think they're interesting. So they happen, of course, in the context of the Cold War. Yeah. And those displays of military might are meant to send a signal to the Soviet Union and to the Chinese, presumably. Both Eisenhower and Kennedy were veterans of the Second World War.
And in Eisenhower's case, also the First World War.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. And obviously they had very different roles in the Second World War. Both men had served in the military and served in combat, and both appreciated and respected the civilian supremacy and civilian control of the military. And, of course, I think the Cold War context is all important. But this tradition didn't really continue. It doesn't happen with later presidents, and I think the reason for that is, as with so many things in the second half of the 20th century, goes back to Vietnam. Mm. And so after Vietnam cranks up, we don't see these kind of military displays. Certainly not at inaugurations.
No.
And the last big military parade we've had in the United States was in 1991 to mark the end of the first Gulf War.
Sure.
And what was interesting about that parade, I think, is it was an old-style parade, a bit akin to that in 1946 or 1919. They expected a million people, but only 200,000 people came.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. And I think that the first Gulf War is a little bit of an outlier if one considers the conflicts the United States has been involved in since 1945, in that it had a clear end.
Sure. There's no parade for Korea. There's no parade for Vietnam. There's obviously all these sort of smaller military conflicts the United States has been involved in during the 20th century. You know, don't lend themselves to parades. Invasion of Panama doesn't lend itself to a parade.
No.
You know, and likewise, the wars we're in, the United States is in today, you know, these are not conflicts that portend to have a clear, definitive ending. I mean, the closest we've had to it, and it's not a military parade, but it sort of functioned oddly in a similar sort of way, was in the end of the what we now think of as being the very early stages of the Iraq War, but was then not necessarily seen that way, was when George W. Bush flew that jet to the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished sign behind him. I mean, that had a symbolic sort of, in some ways, was trying to sort of position itself, at least the way the banner was suggesting, as being a sort of a terminal military signal that hostilities had ended. And obviously that was totally wrong on all kinds of levels.
Sure, but the slight difference there is what we saw then, and we've seen this throughout American history, frankly, is a president using the military as a prop.
Yes.
So interestingly, he didn't do, you know, the mission accomplished moment, you know, happened on an aircraft carrier, which is, you know, to use the contemporary parlance, a safe space for George W. Bush, because frankly, he was very unpopular at that point, or, you know, so he couldn't have done, he could not necessarily have done it without dissent if he tried to make a similar statement in Washington or New York or some other American city at the time. So I think that's slightly different than a parade, which, and the question of a parade does go to, well, and you raised this a minute ago, okay, who's marching or what's on display, but what's the intended audience and who's meant to benefit from this? And one of the suspicions, and you and I talked about this off air, is that President Trump may want this parade as much as a celebration of himself. Or perhaps primarily as a celebration of himself and his own strength as much as anything. Now, the counter view has been made by the White House that this is an opportunity to acknowledge the contribution of the U.S. Armed Forces and their ongoing sacrifices that have been going on since 2001. So that's the official stated position of the White House on this, but there is a little bit of suspicion among Trump's critics that's not the case.
I mean, I think there's I'm not going to take the White House at its word at the moment just because I don't trust them right now, but I think there's a couple of things going on with this proposed Trump march. I mean, one, I think, is they're clearly trying to signal to North Korea, signal to Russia, signals to China, signals to whoever it is that the United States sees as its adversary, that you know, the military might and power, I think that is in line with Trump's conception of how foreign policy works, that you demonstrate strength, and one of the ways in which you demonstrate strength is through, you know, visible acts of aggression. or at least...
Or demonstrations.
Demonstration of power, which is sort of a very veiled, not even all that veiled threat of, you know, we have these soldiers, we have these tanks, we have these planes, we have these missiles. Don't mess with us. So I think there's that, you know, as a tool of foreign policy, I think that's, you know, one of the ways in which the Trump administration might be conceiving of this parade. I think there's also a political end to this parade, in as much as, you know, the military is politically right now associated much more with the Republican Party than with the Democratic Party. That people in the military tend to vote Republican, that people, Republicans on the whole, seem to be more comfortable with the military in a way, or military culture and the sort of trappings of military culture at the moment, than most Democrats are. And I realize I'm painting with a very broad brush there, but, you know, I'm wondering if they're seeing there being the kind of mode of patriotism favored by the Republican Party as being militarized. And we've talked, you know, there's ways in which certain parts of American culture have become militarized in the past, especially I think since 9/11, that would have been unrecognizable, say, in the 1980s.
Right. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, David. I mean, I suspect there's more political diversity in the military than perhaps your generalization allows. But I think in terms of the broader American public and civilians,
yes,
that there's more sympathy for the military, even if many on the right side of the spectrum than the left. Even if many people, many of those Republican cheerleaders for the military haven't themselves served.
They have bone spurs.
Well, yes. I think the military is probably more complicated, especially given the high proportion of minorities among enlisted men.
To be sure, but I think the political valence right now of the ways in which, you know, the claiming support for the military seems to pull a Republican more.
Yeah, right. I agree. But so did support for the FBI until recently. So.
Oh, to be sure.
So things changed. So I think that's right. I think you're absolutely right that we've seen, so although the United States doesn't usually have, sorry, let me back up. The United States does have a history of military parades, so what Trump is proposing is not unprecedented, and we've just spent the past few minutes discussing it. Having said that, these are infrequent. You can actually name them. 1919, 1942, 1946, 1953, 1957, 1961, 1991. I think that's
the recent ones. Yeah.
But the fact that you... Oh, and the Grand Review. But the fact that you can basically count them on two hands suggests that while there is a history to this, there's not a tradition of it. Having said that, what has emerged, and I think you're absolutely spot on about this, is a kind of militarization of American life in different ways. I think I date it slightly earlier. I think that 1991 parade and the Gulf War, which was very much about... It was about the Gulf War, but it was also drawing a line under Vietnam, finally, and saying, you know, we've put this behind us. And I think that was kind of the intention. And there was a kind of creeping militarization began even before the before 9/11. It really ratcheted up after 9/11.
I mean, I think it ratcheted up in a couple of ways. Because, I mean, I remember after 9/11 sort of the visible presence of things like anti-aircraft guns in D.C., you know, things designed to stop the next terrorist attack, and the visible presence of the military in public spaces.
And the military in uniforms when they're just uniform military personnel.
Well, you know, that's one thing I noticed. Also, you know, when you were flying after 9/11, the number of times you would see uniformed military in airports and in other kinds of public spaces was really quite striking.
Yeah,
because they, you know, I'm not entirely sure what the reasons for that are, but the military visibility, I think, definitely amped up, and not only, you know, in lived experience, but also in things like, you know, thinking of the Super Bowl that just happened, sporting events became increasingly militarized in some ways, and patriotic.
Oh, Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, every sporting event is preceded by about 20 minutes of celebration of the military.
And jets flying over and all the kinds of things. And that wasn't the case, you know, not that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, we discussed this a little bit when we talked about the singing of the national anthem in an earlier episode. But no, I completely agree with you about that. And we've seen that. I think that is more pervasive. And that, you know, the dispute or the debate, if we can call it that, about NFL players protesting and kneeling during the national anthem is about this as well. Mm. This has become really pronounced in the past 20 years.
Yes.
And certainly since 9/11. And it's potentially a quite baneful influence given the importance of civilian control of the military in the United States, or to the history of the United States.
And so, thinking about that civilian control, should we be worried now? I mean, are we in a position where we should be worried that the military has a greater role in public and political life than is healthy and appropriate, given the traditional civilian control of the military, and military being obedient and responsible to non-military authority?
Well, we should always be concerned about that.
Okay.
Particularly given particularly the strength and power of the United States Armed Forces, just the sheer size of it. If you know, if the U.S. military wanted to have a coup, well, they're in a pretty good position to do so. Now, in fairness, that does not seem likely.
Okay.
Having said that, if we think beyond the military, but we also include law enforcement, I think and this is something we talked about last week, I think the Trump administration's struggle with the FBI and the Justice Department, which I recognize is not the military, but there's a kind of... There's a spectrum here of state use of force, I think.
Yes.
Is very worrying. And I don't believe there's a conspiracy in the FBI or the CIA or the so-called deep state against the Trump administration. But the more the Trump administration, and more importantly, its allies in right-wing media, and I'm thinking of Fox News and Breitbart and so on, make that case, it erodes civilian faith in these institutions.
Yes.
And those institutions become politicized. Now, I realize that hasn't happened with the military yet. Quite the contrary, because Trump and his supporters, if anything, you know, believe the military is sacrosanct. But it's a slippery slope.
So, yes.
Having said that, we always need to be concerned in a democracy about maintaining civilian control.
Yeah, I mean, thinking back to the, you know, our discussion of the Kennedy and Eisenhower inaugurations. So on the one hand, both those are men with military backgrounds. Eisenhower, obviously, that was his entire career. Kennedy, less so, but both of them are veterans. Both of them are using the military in this, you know, visible way in their inaugurations. But they were both deeply skeptical about actually the role of the military in government when they're in the White House.
Yes, Eisenhower gave us the phrase military-industrial complex as a warning.
You know, and thinking about the, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, Kennedy was very concerned that the military was going to, you know, wasn't fully constrained in its actions and choices, and that, you know, many of the steps he took during the Cuban Missile Crisis was try to, as much deal with what's going on in Cuba and what's going on in the Soviet Union, but try to keep a lid on what's going on in the U.S. military, who often had their own sort of priorities and objectives about how to proceed in that situation. You know, so there's a skepticism of the military that runs, I think, throughout American history, and a fear of military power. I mean, part of the reason why, when we mentioned this, you know, part of the reason why we don't have military parades for most of the 19th century is there isn't an army to parade. You know, this supposition that standing armies are bad things, they are unhealthy for a republic to have, and we, you know, have an army when we need one to fight a war. But the ideal situation is as small a military as possible to meet the defensive needs of the country. And I think that notion is, you know, long dead now. you know, the idea that the military should be shrunk to be as small as it possibly can be. I think there's been a rhetoric about strengthening the military that I've, throughout the Cold War and to through today that I find disturbing.
Well, there was a mobilization in 1942, and notwithstanding that parade in 1946 and the demobilization of millions of soldiers, a military establishment was created in 1942 that has really been in place ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And one can see incrementally how it happened because of the Cold War and so on and so forth. But and now the United States has this rather massive military industrial complex, as Eisenhower called it, that isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And to some extent permeates many aspects of American life that would have been unthinkable not even that long ago. Having said that, we also have this paradox. We're only, in terms of the more recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in the broader war on terror in Central Asia and elsewhere, that war is being waged, or the troops that are serving around the world in hotspots on behalf of the United States, it's only 1% of the population.
Yes.
So we have this culture of venerating the military, and everybody wants to sort of salute the flyover at a football game, et cetera, and
yeah.
Love the troops. Only 1% of the country are the troops.
And you know, often not only is it a very small percentage of the population, but it tends to be in certain pockets demographically. It tends to run certain kinds of communities and families, which means that the vast majority of Americans have relatively little personal connection to the military. And as a consequence of that, also very little stake in what, you know, even people who are deeply interested in the sort of image of the military don't actually have, you know, family members or friends who are in the military. Which, so we have this very interesting paradox where the military has been venerated, but very few people have, you know, this tangible, meaningful connection with it, including lots of people in Congress, right, and in government generally. You know, so obviously President Trump was not in the military. Don't think Vice President Pence was in the military.
I don't think so. I'm not sure.
Paul Ryan was not in the military. Mitch McConnell was not in the military.
Barack Obama wasn't. It goes on the other side of the aisle as well, to be sure.
You know, there are relatively few, which I think is a very different situation than what we've had for most of American history, in which military service was a common and in some ways unifying feature of people who were in government, either in the White House or in Congress.
And almost a requirement. I mean, you couldn't run for office in the 50s and 60s if you had, you know, people would have asked, well, where, what did you do during the war? Having said that, I wonder if that's not changing, David, both because we're going to have we've had nearly 20 years of war since 9/11, or 17 years, and There's a
class of people like the Tammy Duckworths
there's a cohort in Congress that are, you know, that served in those conflicts.
Yes.
So that may well change. And we'll look back and say, actually, there was a period, kind of post Vietnam period, when we had politicians who hadn't served, but maybe that may become a rarity.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's interesting that we now have veterans and, you know, running for office and what have you on both political parties, but you know the percentage of people who really understand the military from personal experience is still a very small segment of the population. So, you know, we can think about, you know, the 2004 campaign, where you had one person who hadn't served in Vietnam but wraps himself in the military, and the other person who had 3 Purple Hearts, but the sort of military valence seemed to actually side the person who wasn't, didn't have military service. And obviously there's more complications to that election than that. But
do you think the parade will happen, David? Trump-palooza.
That's a really good question. I hope I mean, I hope not. I don't think it would be good. I don't think it's a good use of money. I think it's going to be expensive and stupid. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to do something and call that a military parade. But what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think what will happen is I think there will be a parade of some kind, because the Pentagon seems to be planning for something. I think it'll probably be presented to the public as a thank you to the troops, a celebration of the troops who've been serving over the past 20 years. Then, if they're smart, they'll include Vietnam veterans as well. I don't know whether that's smart, and that might be a little too sensitive for President Trump.
So I think if they
frame it as being about thanking the troops for their service, as opposed to making a demonstrate lots of missiles and tanks to make America look strong and Trump look strong, I think that would be the way to go. I don't know which way they'll go, because he seems to want a Bastille Day parade with lots of hardware.
I think one of the things, thinking about these parades and thinking about the kinds of parades that happen at the local level, there is an American tradition of having parades of veterans that has very deep roots.
Yes, that's true.
You know, so thinking about the Grand Review in 1865, throughout the late 19th century, you know, you had Decoration Day parades, which eventually became Memorial Day, where you would have Union veterans marching through the streets. You know, and they're marching through the streets even when a lot of them can barely march at all, right? You know, and recognizing veterans for their service when they are no longer soldiers, you know, and which, you know, is a very different kind of message and symbolism than tanks and planes and bombs and,
right,
and active duty
soldiers.
That's right.
You know? That's right.
And I very much think that at least the my understanding of what the Trump administration is thinking about is very much more the bombs and tanks and planes than it's the demonstration of military might rather than the honoring people for the service they've already engaged in.
Right. I guess what I was saying is I think there'll be a parade, and if they were smart, they'd honor the people for their service, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so those are two separate points, right?
Fair enough.
There will be a parade, and if they are smart, you know, given what we know.
The politics of the country are so polarized at the moment that, you know...
Which, of course, now is in shutdown, but then not in shutdown, then it was in shutdown again. Who knows what's
right,
happening.
You know, if he has a big display of military might, it will be widely derided by his critics and celebrated by his supporters.
To be sure.
And very little will be achieved, I suspect.
Exactly. Yes, other than tearing up the roads in D.C.
Yeah.
All right, Frank, it's time for the last drops. What you got?
I have something historical, but it's not American necessarily, David. There's a new book out, an NPR reported about this, by a woman named Penn Vogler, called Dinner with Dickens. And what she has done, she's a kind of food historian. She has, it's a cookbook and a study of the food in Dickens's novels. And you know I like Victorian novels.
Is the food any good?
It's not really to my taste. But anyway, that's not the real takeaway from this as far as I can see. the headline from the stories about this new book is that she went through and she has a thesis that the villains in Dickens drink coffee and the heroes drink tea. And the reason this is important, dear listeners, is because we don't normally drink whiskey during these recordings, I'm sorry to say, because we often record in the morning and we're at work. However, we do drink. And so I usually drink tea and David drinks coffee. David is a coffee drinker and I'm a tea drinker. So the clear conclusion you could draw is I am a heroic figure and David is a villain.
Or the other alternative one could draw is that real Americans drink coffee and people who have been Anglophiled by living here for 20-something years drink tea, and that, you know, Charles Dickens hates America and, you know, real Americans drink coffee.
You could draw that conclusion. I have been here longer than you, although I came as a tea drinker. I was expelled from America for being a tea drinker.
Yeah, how can a guy from Boston be a tea drinker? You're supposed to drink it, dump it in the harbor, not drink the stuff.
Yep.
Anyway,
so the villainous David.
The villain, yeah, I'm happy to take on that mantle. Sure, if drinking coffee makes me a villain, then I'm like a super villain. drink
pots next of coffee. That's a new Netflix show. Exactly. A super villain who drinks coffee.
Yeah, okay. I'll figure out what kind of powers I get from that.
What's yours, David?
So there's a really disturbing report that came out earlier this week that says that only 8% of American high school seniors point to slavery as the cause of the Civil War, which, for those of you listening, slavery is the cause of the Civil War. Lots of people have been sort of trying to take this finding and figure out what it means, other than American history education at the secondary level, it needs a lot of help. But one explanation that people have come up with for why so few high school seniors can point to this clearly central fact of American history has to do with the fact that the history of slavery itself is often not being taught either extensively or well or at all in American schools. And, you know, the report that this comes from cites a number of reasons why this might be. Partially, the teachers don't feel comfortable teaching about slavery. They don't feel like they have the resources to teach about slavery. Sometimes state standards don't support teaching a great deal about slavery. Obviously, teaching slavery can be contentious within the classroom, depending on the demographics of the classroom and the community. But it's really, I think, a disturbing finding. I think we need to sort of think more about why, even after, you know, all the attention paid to slavery as the cause of the war during the recently completed sesquicentennial, why that hasn't really translated into a broader common understanding, at least among high school seniors. So,
right,
depressing things to think about, but I'm a super villain. So,
well, we've got lots of work to do.
To be sure, yes. Like, the upside of which is there's still lots of work for historians to do. So I guess, you know, jobs for our PhD students.
Excellent.
Excellent. All right, cheers. David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.